It's Sunday morning, time for the great outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. Thank you so much for being with me as we move into the first Sunday of March. Pretty hard to believe that's just happened. Snow geese. Let's talk about that for a moment. A bird that we really in the Midwest never heard, saw, didn't think about. 50 years ago, and this really is a story of evolution of birds and how we think of things in a constant way, but they really are not. And while we think of generations for people as being decades long, for birds, case of snow geese, it's just 1 year, maybe two. So go back to the beginning. Go back 100 years ago, and snow geese were nowhere near as numerous as they are today. In fact, they were actually kind of rare. They nested up high in the Arctic on Hudson Bay and James Bay, and they made virtually a nonstop migration from the Arctic to the Gulf Coast of Louisiana and Texas, and actually way on into Mexico, down on the east coast of Mexico. And they did this because there was no agricultural crops and fields for them to feed in on the way down. Think about the countryside. It was grass. It was marshes. And the birds pretty much just flew. And the mortality was high. As croplands took over, birds were slow to adapt. But sometime about 50 years ago, snow geese began to realize that what they were flying over was a buffet table that was perfectly set for them. And this began the dynamics of one of the greatest population increases in bird history. And today we fear that we may have an overpopulation of snow geese. They've been predicting this for quite a while. It hasn't happened yet. They keep expanding their range and in their population. So 50 or 60 years ago, it started. They started to stop on their way south, and they started to replenish their calories and did not fly all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. It took them longer to get there, and when they arrived, they were in better condition, and there was a lot less mortality. And therefore, when they went back north in the spring, again, they weren't making these long flights. They were stopping along the way and eating. And when they arrived on the breeding grounds of Hudson and James Bay, they were in much better condition. And as a result, they produced a lot more young, and the population began to increase, and so on. So over time, they kept stopping along the way south until they decided, why do we need to go south all the way to begin with? And today, the most fabled snow goose wintering areas on the continent are not what they were half a century ago. There are almost no snow geese that venture into Mexico. The great snow goose populations of 40 and 50 years ago along the coast, along the Gulf of Mexico or Gulf of America, whatever you want to call it, on the east coast of Texas, no geese. In the great goose prairie, the Katy Prairie, south of Houston. Of course, now there are a lot of houses there, but the Katy Prairie was known to be the epicenter of snow goose populations in the world, almost no snow geese. The Louisiana coast was fabled for the huge numbers of snow geese, very few snow geese to no snow geese at all. Instead, today, snow geese winter in Arkansas, Mississippi, the Boot Heel of Missouri. They're wintering on up into Tennessee, into Kentucky, and it's ever northward. And today, in the delta of the Mississippi between Memphis and Vicksburg, one of the most productive agricultural regions on earth, at night, it's deafening. It's not the sound of frogs, which it is in the summer. It's the sound of snow geese. By literally the millions, snow geese have landed in the Mississippi Delta and over on the Grand Prairie of Arkansas, and it is deafening roar. So all those birds that used to go south to Louisiana and Texas and into Mexico, they're stopping now in Arkansas, Mississippi, southeast Missouri. What's next? They're not going to go that far eventually. They're just going to keep going only as far south as they need to go. And if you're in Mississippi right now, in the Mississippi Delta or the Grand Prairie of Arkansas, that's probably music to your ears, because literally the snow geese have taken over the environment, the winter landscape of an area that, that had none. And also snow geese eat a lot of food, and they are taking away valuable waterfowl duck habitat in these areas. Now they're being totally taken over by snow geese. So brings us to Illinois. We now, if you look, step outside, south wind, warming temperatures, virtually anywhere you are in Illinois, you're going to hear snow geese going ahead. They're beginning to going overhead. They're beginning to move north. So Illinois now becomes one of the largest spring staging areas for snow geese, as does Iowa, southern Illinois, the Effingham area, east of St. Louis, Vandalia, Lake Carlisle, Lake Shelbyville, all the way up into Peoria. Huge, huge staging area now for snow geese moving north. So they're leaving Illinois and they're going up in the Dakotas. And then from the Dakotas, they're leaping up into Canada and onto the Arctic. And they leap forward in the best breeding conditions possible, and their population only continues to expand. So we think about the decline in bird populations, the Cornell study, we have 3 billion fewer birds. There's no question that songbirds are in deep trouble. Something is going on that, that we don't understand, and it's very, very troubling. In the case of snow geese, and also Canada geese, but really snow geese, it seems like there's no limit to the population increases that snow geese can experience. And they are expanding west. A snow goose in Nebraska was unheard of. A snow goose in Montana, very, very rare. And now they're absolutely common. So as snow geese have changed generationally, and just think, really think of every 2 years as a generation. First year, they're not very, very good at reproducing. So every 2 years as a generation, we've got 30 generations or so of snow geese, or 40 generations of snow geese that have evolved to today's landscape, and they've evolved to be highly successful, incredible breeders, feeding all the way down, feeding all the way back north. So when they arrive in the Arctic, it is true. They are literally eating themselves out of a house and home in areas that were prime colony breeding habitats in the Arctic 25 and 30 years ago. Now are just grubbed to dirt. There's literally very little growing. No problem for the snow geese. They just move a little bit. And because snow geese are colony nesters, they move in these enormous colonies. And they're pioneering north and west all the time. There is a lot of Arctic for snow geese to pioneer into, which is why in their southward migration, the great flights that used to go through right over Winnipeg and straight on down the Delta Marsh area west of Winnipeg in Canada was a prime wintering area, early fall staging area for snow geese. The same of Rock Lake, North Dakota, that whole area, you won't see a snow goose in the fall. The great hunting camps that were built around snow goose hunting, they're all gone. It had to move west, and now the epicenter of snow geese are out in western Saskatchewan, moving actually into Alberta. It's incredible how they've moved west. So we think of birds and animals as being static. Really not at all. They're evolving all the time, and they've had to evolve through time to survive, just as humans have. But the pace of evolution of the snow goose and the changing of their habitats is truly amazing, and we can learn a lot from it. So when we think we're watching a population in real trouble, there are chances that they're going to evolve through evolution to adapt. The snow goose is probably the best example I can think of a population now where there are more snow geese on the face of the earth than there ever have been on the face of the earth. It's not a conservation success story. It's an agricultural success story and the ability of birds to adapt. When I come back from the break, I'm going to talk a little bit about how we can build efficiency and, if you will, smarter Department of Interior, smarter Department of Ag, and what some of the things are headed there as well. And then I have to end with a look at the drought map, which is not a very pretty map right now if you're interested in breeding birds on the prairies. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back in just a moment with much more on the Great Outdoor Show. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN. And first, a message from our longtime sponsors, the Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
Hiking, camping, and hunting, it's all an adventure in the great outdoors, but nature can be tough. You need to be ready for anything and everything. Chevy Silverado is built to handle the toughest conditions and get you everywhere you want to go worry-free. Silverado's designed to handle the big jobs. It's built for the great outdoors. With over 13,000 pounds of towing capacity and trailering sway control, Silverado can haul the biggest loads on the roughest roads and keep you cool as a Sunday drive. With 8 available cameras and up to 14 different views, it can spot trouble before it gets to you. That's peace of mind. And when you're ready for the backcountry, Chevy Silverado 1500 ZR2 owns the off-road. You name it, we run over it. No wonder it's Motor Trend's 2023 four-wheeler pickup truck of the year. So see your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and check out a Chevy Silverado. It's freedom to explore the great outdoors.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio, and thank you for joining me for that tale of snow geese and how they have evolved over time to be one of the most incredibly successful and adaptive birds on the face of the planet. And in Illinois right now, when you go outside, as the spring winds warm up from the south, you can hear the wonderful cries of snow geese as they fly high overhead in V's headed north. It's a great sight, and one certainly that we were not in years past, decades past, privileged to be able to see. So what is going on with the efforts of the government to reduce waste, abuse, fraud? We all are reading every day and hearing, you know, hourly almost on funds that are misspent or were misspent or spent in a direction that maybe could be reviewed. I want to focus for a moment on the other end of the table, and that is, so we end up reducing these agencies by governmental agencies by significant portions, both in terms of headcount and in terms of budget. What then? What then is we better end up with a government that's far more efficient and that has adapted modern technology and reduced programs that are duplicitous. Who's working on that? That's a question that I have. Is it's easy to tear down, easy to find waste. We, in any business, any CEO every year is challenging their team members to figure out a way to be more productive, to trim expenses, to grow the top line. In this case, we are taking serious steps to reduce the size and weight of the federal government. And when it comes to conservation, we need a plan that says, okay, once we've done this, we need it across the board, obviously, but let's just talk about what's relevant to the Great Outdoors Show, conservation. Once we've done this, how are we going to be smarter? How are we going to be more efficient? How are we going to utilize the resources we have better? Who is going to utilize these resources? Because the personnel counts are going to be way down, and you may be sitting here listening saying, that's fabulous. Or you may be sitting here listening, saying, I don't think that's fabulous. That's not the point of my conversation this morning. The point of my conversation is, where is the work being done that enables us to come out the other end of this with a much more efficient federal government, a much more efficient Department of Interior, a much more effective Department of Agriculture? Those are the things that I focus on and I think about here on the Great Outdoors Show as I talk to you each week. Department of Interior and the Department of Agriculture are going to remain very large. Can they remain effective? And certainly in the case of organizations like the Bureau of Land Management, which manage just huge tens, hundreds of millions of acres, can they use technology? And I think one of the things that I'm hearing across the board is that technology is actually going to replace a lot of the human interactions that we have at Interior and at Ag. So if you're in agriculture and you're accustomed to walking into your Natural Resource Conservation Service and having a cup of coffee and talking to the individuals behind the desk about conservation and the programs you can sign up for, you probably better go have that cup of coffee pretty quickly, because that chances are that NRCS office is going to be slimmed down dramatically, or it's not even going to be there. It will have been consolidated. Is that a bad thing? Not if we use technology to be more efficient, sitting in the kitchen of your farmyard, your farmhouse, wherever you might be listening this morning. You can do almost everything with your agricultural sign-up programs for conservation and otherwise that you had to go into an office to do. So I think the challenge for conservation is Can we make it better? Can we take the resources we have and use them more efficiently? The one thing we know is it's changing quickly, and a lot of the individuals that we interacted with, either in Washington or out in the field, are not going to be there. A lot of the programs are going to be reassigned. There's still going to be a lot of money spent on conservation, and our job, I think, is to make sure it's spent wisely. After we get through with this reduction, we definitely have the challenge of, okay, now we got to have something that really works for everyone, because we decided what we had didn't work, but we don't necessarily right now have a plan for making it work better. And I'm sure that there's some very competent people working on this right now as I speak to you, and let's hope that they are, because that's what we need. We're going to need a master plan for delivering agricultural conservation programs in the future and Department of Interior programs in the future that is built upon a different business model than we have spent our lives knowing. And that's a radical change, but it's here. And the question is, can we take advantage of it? I'll have more on that in the coming weeks, I'm sure. I'll be talking with individuals who actually may have a hand in making some of these input suggestions. And hopefully we in the WGN world can help make, in fact, Department of Interior and the Department of Agriculture better service. So speaking before I have to go for the day, I have to talk for a moment about wind farms, which it seemed like they couldn't build them fast enough 6 months ago. And right now, all you read is wind projects being halted, stopped, people going broke who are in the wind business. One of the biggest wind projects that had been proposed was this project called the Lava Ridge Project on the Bureau of Reclamation Lands in Idaho. I mentioned it a few weeks ago. It had been opposed by the entire Idaho delegation, was extremely unpopular in the West, and yet it was at the last minutes of the Biden administration, the orders from the BLM director to start the project were issued. And here we are a month later, and all those orders have been rescinded. The Lava Ridge Wind Project, extremely controversial, as so many of them are, has been stopped dead in its tracks until they can do a review. So over the past year, I talked about the green energy plan of the Biden administration, not partisan. It was the Biden administration plan, relied on a heavy use of public lands in the American West for solar and wind farms. The problem was the Western states didn't want this. Many of the most prized recreation areas for hunting and hiking in the American West, or most beautiful landscapes, were going to be threatened with this green energy plan of windmills and solar farms. And the Western states and the people who live there just didn't want to see that happen. And yet the BLM, Bureau of Land Management, was saying it's going to happen and here it comes. Well, now it's all changed. And there is a bill, which I've mentioned before as well, in Congress working its way through that will require the state where a federal project is to take place, would require the state's legislature to sign off on that project before it takes place. That only makes sense. So it isn't, I mean, it's hard to keep up with the pace of change right now. There are going to be incredible opportunities to do things more efficiently, and there are also going to be some challenges we face. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back next week with much more on the great outdoors. And I ran out of time to talk about the drought index, but right now it doesn't look like a very happy setting on the prairies, given what we're seeing today. We still have about 6 weeks to change all that. Thanks for listening. This is Charlie Potter in the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.